Velkommen til Informationsforsamlingshus. Mit navn er Lene Winther, og jeg er avisens udlandsredaktør. Den 16. april fik vi her på avisen besøg fra Israel. Det var en tidligere soldat i den israelske hær, som lagde vejen forbi. Han hedder Ori Givati og er talsperson, advocacy director, for den israelske NGO Breaking the Silence, som består af veteraner fra den israelske hær, der siden er blevet kritiske over for selvsamme hær og dens metoder. Formålet med gruppen er at oplyse om, hvordan den israelske hær opererer i de besatte palæstinensiske områder og sætte en stopper for besættelsen. Ori Givati besøgte Danmark for at fortælle om sin opfattelse af krigen mellem Israel og Hamas, og hvad han tror ligger bag de høje drabstal inde i Gazastriben. Ori Givati tjente selv som soldat fra 2010 til 2013 i de besatte områder, og det var under dette arbejde, at han indså, at han fandt den militære kultur umenneskelig. Nu skal du høre min samtale på engelsk med Ori, hvor jeg først spørger ham, hvad der oprindeligt fik ham til at melde sig ind i Breaking the Silence.
Okay, so hi everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm happy to be here and share all of this with you. So I'll dive right into your first question. I grew up in a very classic Israeli family from a small village, voters of the Labour Party, center-left, you know. And one of the main things I grew up, one of the main concepts I grew up to believe in by, you know, my family, by my education system, by the media, everything, is that one of the best things that I can do with myself is to become a combat soldier in the military, in order to protect my country, in order to protect my friends when I turn 18, yeah, not when I'm... I was always very excited to do that. I was very, you know, that's how we grew up in Israel. Very encouraged and very excited to protect our country and our families. So I never even doubted it. I didn't have also a lot of opportunities to question it or ask questions about it, because there isn't even a reason to ask questions about it, because it's obvious that that's what you have to do. You know, that's how we are raised. And I turned, in my case, it was when I was 19. We all have mandatory service, 3 years. I joined the military. I was a tank commander. Yeah, commanded a tank, a team of 4 soldiers and a tank. And during my service, I served here and there in the occupied territories. I started having some questions, but... I was discharged after 3 years. I went to work in agriculture in the north of Israel. And I did that for 3 years as well. And in January 2016, I was called on reserve duty. Reserve duty is when we are called back to the military just for a few weeks usually, sometimes a few days, usually for training, but sometimes to do some operations, some missions around the occupied territories. Yeah. So I was 25 years old. I'm no longer a young person that doesn't have any, you know, strong opinions or something. I was like that. Not some young people have amazing opinions. I wasn't. I was just very, you know, mainstream. But now I'm 25, and I'm suddenly sent to occupy millions of people. And I'm invading their villages. I'm, you know, one of the missions was to start a checkpoint between 2 Palestinian villages in the West Bank. Another mission I received was to guard some Palestinians who were captured by another unit, and they were brought to our base, and it wasn't really clear what we're going to do with them. And anyway, like so many different small examples, you know, even the smallest one that I really remember, just stopping a very elderly Palestinian with his sheep and checking his ID inside his own village, you know, not on the way to Israel or something like that. Anyway, many of these different missions made me start questioning the very basic assumption that made me want to be a combat soldier, which is, what is the relation between the relationship between what I'm actually doing right now to what I thought and I was told that I will do, which is to protect my country and my family. Yeah? I'll give one concrete example. So one night, my commander calls me and tells me we have to open a checkpoint in this random spot in the West Bank. And I'm very excited, you know, I want to do missions and so forth. So we go, it's like 2 a.m. It was after we invaded a village, another mission. And we open a checkpoint. I'm standing there in the checkpoint and I'm starting to think. Yeah, a checkpoint is very basic, like, you know, so spikes, stop sign, and you just stop cars that come randomly on that road. And I'm starting to ask myself, I'm now between two Palestinian villages. I'm not on the way to Israel. I'm not on the way to a settlement. I don't have intelligence. Like, he didn't tell me we need this checkpoint because there is this car that is going to pass or a specific individual that we need to capture. Nothing. And he also told me, be there for like 2 hours and come back. And I'm risking my life. You know, like, that's the first thing. Like, I'm risking my life. What am I risking my life for? I don't have any mission here except doing it for 2 hours. And this is an example, you know, not a crazy incident where I saw someone shot or nothing. I never saw anything like that. Just the routine of the control, the way we disrupt daily life, that made me ask some questions that eventually, of course, there were many different small incidents like that, brought me to where I am today. And I joined Breaking the Silence in 2017. I was a researcher collecting testimonies from soldiers who, like me, started having questions and wanted to talk about their service. And in the last 4 years, I'm the advocacy director, so I'm responsible for all of our international work, international relations, and so forth.
And what is the core purpose of Breaking the Silence?
So our purpose is pretty straightforward. In order to end the occupation. We believe that we have a very important and unique role as the perpetrators, as the victimizers, not as the victims, but as the victimizers of the occupation, to bring forward this reality from the point of view of the people who did it, of the people like me who did a checkpoint or invaded a village or fought a war in Gaza, you know, or were in the control room, in the camera room. Anyone who took part in the occupation, it doesn't have to be full combat. It can be anyone, logistics, anything that's related to the occupation. And through our experiences and our unique voice as soldiers who were sent to do it, to expose this reality and generate a discussion, which is a moral discussion. We're not looking to generate like a discussion about, you know, some organizations that it costs us this and this money and it's not worth it. Just an example. We are intending to generate a moral discussion of why the occupation is wrong morally, inherently. And we're saying something very simple. There isn't a way to occupy morally. There isn't a way to do it in a moral or a legitimate way. You know, many of the soldiers that come to us talk to us about how, for example, in the first time they invaded a home to arrest someone from that home, even if it's someone that needs to be arrested, okay, like, there are many reasons for arrests, but even if it's someone who needs to be arrested, they entered with candies in their pockets to give to the kids of the person they arrested or, you know, to the brothers or whatever. And they said that after 2-3 times they did it, they stopped doing it because they're saying, I'm taking away their father, I'm giving them candy, you know? And this is just an example of how many of this idea, this false idea that there is a way to occupy in a, you know, legitimate or a good way. You know, many soldiers entered occupation like that, including me, but finished the service in the occupied territories understanding that it's impossible. And that's what they were saying. We're not looking, for example, to, and it's really important to mention, because we're not looking to, I'm not going to tell you now about Gaza, what we're going to talk about in a second, to tell you, look, this is something that is possible to do, but we are doing it wrong. Yeah, that's not what we're saying. We are saying the occupation inherently is immoral. The only way to make it, you know, better is to end it. There isn't a middle way.
So let's go back to the 7th of October last year. It was a Saturday. It was a day when Hamas did their terror attack in Israel. What thoughts went through your head during that day when you first heard about the attack?
So on the 7th of October, I was on vacation with my family, very, very close to Gaza. Luckily, the kibbutz, the people don't know, it's like a village that we were in, was not one of those that was invaded, but was very, very close. So we woke up at 6:30, we hear like tons of shootings and explosions and something we never heard before. And we understand something is happening, but we didn't really know. After a few minutes, we get a text message saying it's possible that there are terrorists in the kibbutz. So everyone go to the bomb shelters and lock yourself there until we know what's next. That's how I experienced, that's the first moment for me of the 7th of October. I usually live in Tel Aviv, but somehow on that day I was right next to Gaza. So I really experienced some of it. You know? During the day, I get messages. I have relatives that live in one of the kibbutzim that was invaded, and they are saying like, we are locked in our bomb shelter, there are like terrorists inside our home. This is the kind of like, while they are shooting at them. So luckily they were saved because they put a piano that in front of them, and the piano blocked all the bullets. That's how my relatives were saved that day. Okay, so we get text messages while the terrorists are trying to kill them. That's how I experienced the first moments. And very, very quickly, when we start seeing videos of terrorists invading cities, kibbutzim, and so forth, start hearing about the hostages, we understand that nothing is going to be the same, and that something awful is happening. And it takes a lot of time to digest. I don't think until now I digested that.
How did it make you feel?
First of all, I felt very scared, you know, terrified from the future. First of all, for my own safety, of course, because at the time I was still next to it. We didn't know what's going on. Yeah, but even after a few hours that we drove really, really quickly away from there, that was also very scary. I started feeling scared for the future, for what's going to happen with this place that I love. You know, I love this place, my home. But understanding that with the current leadership that we have, the kind of response that we will see will be unbelievable, like what we are seeing, unfortunately. And also understanding that we're going to go years back in terms of what we're trying to achieve, which is a peaceful future, a better future, a future without occupation, a future with equality and so forth. And also very, you know, kind of a despair, I have to say. Like, we're trying so hard, and then this completely off the charts, despicable act of killing innocent people, war crime, you know, rape, you know, just name it, for innocent civilians, you know, kids. It really takes a lot of the hope out of you, but we still have to move forward. So that's what we've been trying to do since then.
And do you think that Israel has the right to defend itself against Hamas and against this attack?
Yeah, so I think that, look, the 7th of October, again, as I said, it's completely illegitimate act. There are ways to resist occupation. The 7th of October is not one of those ways. And any country would react, I think, violently against the people who did something like this to it. But I think we have to remember that the fact that the 7th of October happened doesn't mean that Israel can do whatever it wants to millions of people, that 99.9% of them had nothing to do with the 7th of October. And that's, I think, is the root cause of the problem that we're seeing today.
So you support the war, but not the methods that Israel uses in the way it conducts its war.
I wouldn't say I support the war. I think it's not nuanced. Like, I'm not blaming you, yeah, but you know what I mean? Not nuanced, because I support the fact that the 7th of October generally is a legitimate reason for war. I don't support what Israel is doing at all. So it's not that I support this war. I'm just saying that the 7th of October is a legitimate reason for a war, but it doesn't mean that what is happening right now is legitimate whatsoever, and also not what started on the 8th of October, because what we have been seeing since the 8th of October, since the evening of the 7th of October, is a war that is based on revenge. And if there is, and I doubt that there is, okay, but if there is a legitimate, like a good reason to go on war, it's to create a safer future. It's to create a better future. What this war is doing is it's the opposite. And that's why I think that while the 7th generally is a casus belli for a war, it has nothing to do with what we're seeing at the moment.
So you think it's legitimate to defend oneself against an attack like that?
Exactly, but not what we're doing.
And can you tell us, how would you characterize the current strategy of the IDF, the Israeli army in Gaza?
So I think that the main problem is that there isn't a strategy. What do I mean? If you fight a war, you know, the first thing you need is, what are you trying to achieve with this war? That's how you determine what are you going to do in the war. But our government never determined what is the goal of the war, except saying revenge and saying things like all of the Gazans are criminals and the Nazis. You know, yesterday our Minister of Finance says 2 million people in Gaza are Nazis, are complicit. So when this is the government, you know, it's very, very problematic to fight any war like that, you know, because what are you trying to achieve in this war except revenging the terrible atrocities? And then when this is the beginning, then we can dive into what we're actually doing over there. And the numbers that you mentioned, you know, out of this 34, approximately, we're talking about 34,000, yeah? We're talking about 12,000 children. We're talking about 17,000 orphans, yeah? We are talking about hundreds of families that are wiped out in a level that no one knows those people anymore, because all of them have died. You know, like complete families that have no, like no one can even document them, because everyone they knew in those circles died together with them. So, this is a direct result of the way we fight in Gaza for years, combined with the atrocity of the 7th of October and the fact that our government has no goals. So it's just like kind of... I'll say a few more things about that. Our government is made of two types of reasons for this war, yeah? One is the ultra-nationalist right. Yeah, people, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, you know, those very, very extreme ultra-nationalists. For them, this war is the war to return to Gaza. You know, if someone doesn't know, in 2005, Israel removed settlements, Israeli towns that were in the Gaza Strip, removed them. This was very upsetting for the ultra-nationalist right. So for those people, they say this is an opportunity. The 7th of October for them is an opportunity to go back. This is one type of people that are determining decisions in our government. The second are people who only care about their political survival, led by Netanyahu, but all of them support, all of his followers support that. And he is leading this war only according to his political needs, even if it means neglecting the 133 hostages we still have in Gaza, because it doesn't work for him politically, because the extreme right doesn't support releasing them, because it will mean the war stops, which means we can't go back with the settlements. So those are the two. Sorry, go ahead.
And that's the political level.
Yes.
If you now take us into the mind of an Israeli soldier, I know that your organizations have before talked about that the army refers to two principles. One is zero risk to our forces. Another one is called the Dahiya Doctrine. Both principles can explain to us why the death toll of civilians is so high. Can you explain what goes through the mind of an Israeli soldier, and why do you think that the number of killed civilians
is
so high?
So we've been collecting testimonies from Gaza since the beginning of the organization, so 20 years, yeah? And what we have been seeing first and foremost is that with every operation, with every violent operation or war in Gaza, the number of innocent casualties goes up, the amount of destruction goes up exponentially. And we start the next operation from where we ended the last operation. Yeah, what do I mean? For example, if in the last operation in Gaza, it ended with some very big skyscrapers taken down, this war started with taking down skyscrapers, just as an example, like a concrete example. Now, about the casualties. Before I'll talk about these specific doctrines, I think we all have to understand that the way we fight in Gaza, the way Israel fights in Gaza, inherently includes and takes into consideration killing of civilians, okay, of innocent people. The two doctrines, quickly I'll go over them. We have one is the zero risk to our soldiers. What does that mean? It means that one of the main principles is that the way we fight will pose as good as we can, zero risk to our soldiers, meaning that we change, against international law, by the way, the priorities of who is a legitimate target. Okay, what do I mean? International law, civilians are first. Yeah, my civilians, my opponent's civilians, and then my soldiers, their soldiers. Yeah, Israel changed this officially. Yeah. And today, it's my civilians, my soldiers, their civilians, their soldiers. Meaning we put our soldiers before the enemy's civilians. Okay? That is zero risk to our soldiers. That means that the way we conduct war is putting our soldiers first, our soldiers' lives first before civilians. Now, makes a lot of sense, right? I'm Israel. I want to protect my soldiers. It makes a lot of sense. And I'm not against protecting soldiers. Like, I have friends who are fighting in Gaza, unfortunately, but yeah. So, of course, we're not saying I'm against protecting soldiers, but we have to understand this doctrine as a concept. I'll give you the best example, I think. When I served, the order was, if there is doubt, there is no doubt. What does that mean? If there is any doubt that I'm about to shoot an innocent person, I don't shoot. If there is doubt, there is no doubt. Israel flipped this on its head in the last few years, and it's still, if there is doubt, there is no doubt. But now, it's the opposite. It's, if there is any doubt that I'm under risk as a soldier, I shoot.
So what you're saying is that the principle of that you're innocent until you're proven guilty is turned around. So it's the opposite.
In Gaza. In the way we fight in Gaza, not in every,
sure.
Yeah, in Gaza, definitely. And that creates, of course, that's one of the reasons it created. And if we talk about the Dahya doctrine, yeah, the Dahya doctrine is basically, I'll say it briefly, but it basically is a doctrine that says the way we fight wars should include the destruction of infrastructure, civilian and military, yeah, in order to create something called deterrence, like to deter not only the organization or the military we are fighting against, but also the population from wanting or supporting a future war. Okay, very, very basically. But the most important part about it is that it includes, as I said, civilian infrastructure, roads, you know, like power stations, whatever, like anything that is civilian infrastructure. And that, of course, also includes inherently civilian casualties in terms of humanitarian aid and so forth, like humanitarian needs, and like actual people that are killed because of those bombings. So,
but the Israeli army would say that it's a known fact that Hamas operates from within the civilian infrastructure. And it's, how should an Israeli soldier separate between a Hamas warrior and a civilian?
Yeah, definitely, great question. So now we need to dive into how these doctrines that are just like ideas actually take place in action. Okay, so I'll give some examples. For example, every target in Gaza has a number attached to it. That number is the amount of innocent people that we decided that are legitimate to kill in order to destroy the target. For example, a Hamas commander is this level, so 100 people. You know, just an example. This is a real example, okay? In this war, Israel killed the Hamas battalion commander, knowingly that it will kill approximately 100 people that were next to him. Now, you can say, oh, this commander has been hiding within a civilian population because of that. But it doesn't matter in my eyes. Because I don't believe that even if he did it on purpose, it will be legitimate to kill 100 innocent people to kill this battalion commander that, by the way, will be replaced the next second by someone else. Like, it's not even if it wasn't the case, but it's even more, you know. So just one example. Like, Israel determines, oh, we want this target. This war, 20 innocent lives. Every target has that number, you know. And when we look at the numbers of people being killed, innocent people being killed, I think it's very hard to justify, even if you want to say some people, it's war, some people are worth killing innocent lives for. I don't believe that's true in almost any case. But even if you believe it's true, what are these numbers? You know, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 to kill one person, and then say, ah, Hamas are using them as human shields. You know, I think it's a little bit of saying it's an excuse in many ways.
But what about the infrastructure? If Hamas is using the infrastructure to prepare for their war, what should Israel's army do?
Look, I think that, of course, that some of the infrastructure is illegitimate and should be destroyed generally. You know, war tunnels that go under Israeli villages, of course they should be destroyed. But a lot of this infrastructure that we see destroyed is not that, is civilian infrastructure. For example, Israel decided that there should be approximately 1 kilometer from the border with nothing. So we destroyed whole villages, not of Hamas infrastructure, knowingly, of people's homes, because we decided that for security reasons there should be nothing in this strip. You know, we're starting to get testimonies about that. So, of course, we will always have examples of infrastructure that is used for military reasons, and I definitely believe that these kind of things should be destroyed. But when we look at the amount of infrastructure, yeah, we're talking about, like, there are different numbers, but at least 30-40% of, like, anything constructed in Gaza. This is not only Hamas infrastructure. You know, we talk about soldiers that enter homes to stay there during the war, like private innocent people's homes. And when they leave their homes, they are told to burn them. You know, we're told about, this is from a report in Haaretz newspaper, a red line that any unit in Gaza can draw, imaginary. Every person that passes this red line because it's too close, consider a legitimate target. So, again, there are so many examples more that, like, there's, like, so many that we can talk about how the target selection, the way that is actually causing innocent people's lives, is in many, many cases not related at all to destroying Hamas, but is related only to this concept that Palestinian civilian lives are a legitimate target almost always because of the situation of war in Gaza.
But do you acknowledge that Hamas is using civilians as a shield?
Of course they use civilians as human shields, and it's terrible. It's terrible. But this fact doesn't mean that we can continue doing what we're doing and say, oh, it's only because they're using civilians as human shields. By the way, many of the killings of innocent people is not related to that. For example, I'm sure you all heard about the killing of the aid workers, right? They were not a human shield. They were just innocent aid workers that were targeted because someone in the military decided that we should shoot them. So there are many, many examples of that. There are also a lot of documentation of that. And of course, some of them are killed because Hamas are using them as human shields. Of course. But this doesn't mean that all of the innocent people we killed is because of the fact that Hamas did that. And it doesn't mean that even if it's a case like that, like the commander that is hiding between 100 people, it still doesn't legitimize the fact that we will kill 100 people, because then what we are, you know, like, what do I want to be? What Israel says it is, yeah? The most moral army in the world, the abiding international law, and so forth. So maybe you should also do that and not just say that that's what you're doing.
This might be a difficult question, but I mean, what would you do? I mean, how do you think that Israel should have responded and should have conducted their, how to say, response to the Hamas attack?
Look, I think that it's when when thinking about this question, we have to acknowledge the last few decades. You know, we cannot start the 7th of October from the 7th of October. Of course, as I said, completely illegitimate act that is not related to a legitimate resistance whatsoever, so forth. But it's still part of a bigger story, you know, and we have to remember that. We have to remember decades of occupation, of basically destroying any possibility of normal life in Gaza and in the West Bank, yeah? In Gaza more, but still in both places. We have to remember that in many ways, Israel funded Hamas. Not in many ways, directly allowed millions of dollars, billions of dollars to get to Hamas, knowing that they are constructing their military wing for Netanyahu's political reasons. Yeah, so we have to remember all of that and understand that I think we could have prevented the 7th of October if we had a leadership for many years before, yeah, that was thinking about equality, was thinking about peaceful future and so forth. Saying that, yeah, I'll try to answer your question even though all of what I just said, I think that we are lacking here the main component, which is what is the goal? You know, if your goal is to destroy Hamas, I think it's a legitimate goal. Okay, I think after what they did, legitimate goal to destroy them. But there are many ways to destroy an organization like that. I think that the military way is probably the worst one, because what is Hamas' greatest fear? An alternative. Let's try to create a relationship with a better alternative. And of course, there are many obstacles here as well, yeah? But try to create a relationship with better alternative, a Palestinian alternative that is maybe can be a future partner, that is way more risky to Hamas than what is actually happening right now. For example, I'm not the politician, there are many ways, but I think to directly go always to the military way, which we are seeing what it's doing, I think after 6 months we can very clearly say the military way is only bringing us to a worse place. Like, what do I want? I want a safe future for my family, right? The same reason I joined the military, and for my neighbors, the Palestinians, that we will live equally. Yeah, that's what I want. That's what I think is a legitimate goal. What is actually happening right now is the opposite. So it's very clear that the military way is not working. Just an example of what kind of things we need to think about. And to remember that saying destroying Hamas is an idea. Like, we will kill 10,000 more Palestinians, 20,000. It doesn't change the fact that some Palestinians will go to armed resistance. So maybe the other way would be to try and promote collaborations with more moderate people. You know, like, destroying Hamas is not only a military reason. And again, of course, some things should be destroyed. Like, I'm not saying tunnels underneath kibbutzes and villages, yes, they should be destroyed. But you have to think longer. Like, you have to think of the future, not of, like, let's destroy this building and that building.
Mm-hmm. But how would you, could you negotiate with Hamas if the goal of Hamas is to destroy Israel as a state from the river to the sea?
I think, I'll say two things. First, I think that we must negotiate with Hamas until we have all of the hostages back for sure. Like, this is, it's despicable that the government is not doing anything about it, because it's better for them politically, for these people that are running our government. And for them, it's more important to return to the Gaza Strip and build settlements there than retrieving the hostages that they neglected, and it's their fault that they are there at the moment. So about that, of course. About a longer future, I don't think that we need to negotiate with Hamas about a peace agreement, because it's clear that this is not something they are interested in, and not our government, okay? So, of course, and the fact that our government is so right-wing and so extreme is also making it very difficult for me to answer your question, right? But let's say that it was a different government for a second, yeah? I would go for what I just said. Let's work with the more moderate part of the Palestinians, that the Palestinian authority, which also is very problematic and authoritarian and so many problems there, but is more moderate than Hamas. And let's try to work something out in that direction, or with the international community. Like, there are many ways to do it, you know, but what we're seeing now is none of the above, so.
Hmm. One thing that has surprised me is that there isn't more debate in Israel over the high number of death toll, the high death toll number. We had a report a week ago from the streets in Jerusalem where people were demonstrating against Netanyahu, but overwhelmingly supported the war itself. Do you think that, why is the reason why, is there a critical reflection amongst the Israelis on the huge cost of this war?
Yeah. First of all, I will start with a yes. Yeah, there are a lot of people like me, my colleagues, that are against this. We are not enough, but I just want to point that out. Yeah, like it's not only me. Like I think a few hundred thousand Israelis that are in that kind of perception. But of course, we have a huge problem. Of course, the majority of the society doesn't think like this. And to understand it, we have to go to the core issues and to the 7th of October, right? So one of the core issues is the fact that we have been occupying the Palestinians for 57 years. And when you occupy people for 57 years, the way we do, and that's the only way to occupy, unfortunately, there is a very steady process of dehumanization. You know, many Israelis, the only Palestinians they see or ever meet is when they invade their home in the middle of the night to arrest their kid, you know, or when they take their home to use it as a military post, or many, you know, or in a checkpoint. You know, that will be the only Palestinians they meet in their life. And when we work like that on the entire population, by the way, most of the operations don't distinguish between someone who is a terrorist or a violent or wanted or the most innocent Palestinian in the world, right? When I did a random checkpoint, I did it against all of the Palestinians in the area, not against one specific one. So the entire population is seen to us as legitimate targets. That's before the 7th of October, yeah? Now, the 7th of October adds a lot of hate, racism, a lot of legitimization for violence, which are feelings that I can understand, of course, after what we saw, after what happened to my family, you know, like, of course, we can understand how these feelings are generated. But the problem is that if these feelings are translated into military policy, and then when you see that translation between these kind of feelings of revenge and so forth translated into military policy, it also creates a lot of legitimization for what we're seeing now in Gaza. And on top of all of that, our leadership, you know, when your government, all of it, is supporting what we're doing in Gaza and not even saying anything about the innocent people being killed unless they are citizens of another country, like we saw in the aid workers case. Yeah, that was the one of the only cases that there was an investigation of how we killed these innocent people. The only reason for that is that they are not Palestinians.
But do you discuss it in the media? Do the Israeli media report about the Palestinians who die? I mean, is there an open and active debate regarding the death toll within Gaza?
So that's the third element. The fact that our media, except some good ones, but the mainstream media, especially television, became bodies of justification for the war in front of the Israeli society and in front of the international community. So we, as like the Israeli that watches every night the news, will rarely see a footage of the destruction in Gaza or of Palestinian testimonials or so forth. And if they will see, it will be from the point of view of the military. What do I mean? When we do see in Israeli media an interview with a Palestinian, it will be a Palestinian saying something like, yeah, it's terrible what's been going on, but it's the Hamas's fault. You know, that will be the kind of voices of Palestinian voices that we will hear in the media. I think the Israeli media is... I don't think it's keeping the most basic values of journalism at all. Most of them, of course, not all. There are Haaretz newspaper, very important. There are. But the mainstream, the TV, almost never. Like, I know what kind of news, like, for example, you see from here. Of course, that also sometimes includes justification for the war, but it's legitimate because you see also a lot of Palestinian voice and so forth. In Israel, you don't have that. And it's not the reason that our society is not talking about the issue, but it's part of the problem. Okay, I'm not saying that if we would see all of that, suddenly all of society will change. I'm not saying that, but it's part of the problem.
Because Israel, and most people in Israel also have access to international media and can read, you know, BBC, other media, report the other side of the story.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. So I'm saying it's part of the problem. I do believe that if our media would be more professional, and will bring other voices, I believe that more Israelis will want to talk about what's going on. I don't believe that it will solve the problem. I don't think more Israelis will talk about it. And yeah, we have to remember, you know, it's the situation in Israel has been crazy for years and years and years, you know, in terms of the government judicial overhaul, for those of you who heard, and even before this war, you know, like so many different elements. One of the problems we have and that we as a movement are trying very hard to work on is to make people understand that we will never be a democracy if we continue the occupation. We cannot say we're a democracy and do what we're doing in Gaza. Unfortunately, that's too late, right? So it's very, very problematic. But we're trying to say, like, because the protests are focused on democracy. Yeah, but, and we are saying, yes, we want democracy as well, but to overthrow Netanyahu will not make us a democracy. Yeah, it will make us an occupying nation that doesn't have a corrupt prime minister, maybe, because many of them are corrupt, but it will not make us a democracy. The only way to really be a democracy is if we have equality and so forth and not occupy. So that's something that's very, very hard to work on after years of violence and occupation and so forth.
I think a question that many people in Denmark and probably all over the world have is that what can we do as a country, as international community, as a person? What do you think that, for instance, a country like Denmark, the Danish government, or people here could do in order to do something to, to stop?
So I think there are two lanes here. Okay, the first is more specific, right? Like, what are the specific moves that right now the Danish government should do? You know, so again, there are so many, but like, a few examples would be funding of humanitarian aid, especially UNRWA, that was heavily delegitimized by Israel. UNRWA is the main organization providing humanitarian aid in Gaza. It's also the organization for Palestinian refugees, but a different story. Anyway, resume the funding and understanding that this is crucial. Recognition of Palestine, for example. I think this is very important, not only as a moral or like a statement. It's because it's related to what I said earlier. This is something that is frightening Hamas the most, because recognition of Palestine gives a win to the Palestinian Authority, right? It gives a very important recognition of a different entity that can control the Palestinians, which is not Hamas. This is, I think, a very important thing to do, and a lot of countries are going in that direction. I hope Denmark will too in the future. Another example can be the sanctioning of the settlers who are violent toward Palestinians, a move that many countries did recently. Very, very important kind of step. Like, doesn't have to be specific, but like, you know, starting to move forward from the sanctioning of individuals, which is important but not very effective, to targeting the institutions that fund them, or the regional municipalities that fund them or support them. This is very important. So again, there are so many examples like that. But more broadly, I think that's more important, is to understand that a country like Denmark has complicity and responsibility with the occupation. It's not a separate to it, because it has tons, millions of euros of agreements with Israel as a friend, as a partner in many different fields. So that makes you complicit immediately. So first of all, assume this responsibility. And second, understand that pushing Israel in the right direction to end the occupation, to end the war, and help us retrieve our hostages, even if it's against Israel's current government policies, it's not against Israel. That, I think, is a very important thing. Like, if you help us end the occupation or end this war, you're not against Israel. You're against the government policies. That's a very important element we have to remember, because if you want to be a true friend of Israel, you need to help us in the long term. and not just be silent and in front of everything we've been doing. And by the way, way before this war, yeah, like this war is just the peak.
Det var min samtale om krigen i Gaza med Ori Djevati, som er talsperson for den israelske NGO Breaking the Silence, som består af veteraner fra den israelske hær, der siden er blevet kritiske over for selv samme hærs metoder. Ori besøgte Information den 16. april. Jeg hedder Lene Winther og er Informations udlandsredaktør, og jeg håber, at du vil lytte med næste gang i Informationsforsamlingshus.